Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
As part of this week's Best of Only a Game, we decided to rebroadcast my conversation with Stanley Weintraub about a book he wrote almost 10 years ago. In Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce, Mr. Weintraub recounts the tale of the Christmas Eve upon which soldiers on opposite sides of the trenches put down their guns and grenades to trade gifts with each other and play soccer. According to Stanley Weintraub, most historians have paid little attention to the Christmas truce since it lasted only a day and was followed by 4 years of war. When we spoke, I asked the author if the Christmas truce should have been so easily dismissed.
It was of utterly no consequence as far as ending the war was concerned. But had the war ended at that time, there would have been perhaps 20 million fewer dead. A generation of young men would not have been wiped out. Perhaps the world would have been a great deal different. We have no way of knowing. But it represents something else, too. It seems to me to be the last gasp of chivalry in wartime, the last gasp of real brotherhood, the recognition that the people on the other side were like you. And one of the most famous songs remembering the Christmas truce is one by John McCutcheon called Christmas in the Trenches. In it, a trooper from Liverpool says that one thing we learned in the Christmas truce was that on both ends of the rifle, we're the same. And I don't think that recognition has occurred since.
Then one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave them hell.
It's probably hard for most people today to imagine how dreadful the conditions in the trenches during World War I were. You quote one German artist who calls the battlefront the work of the devil.
Yes, this was Otto Dix. Described the landscape of fortified ditches as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, shells, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. And the troops were grateful for this interlude to celebrate Christmas. It was certainly spontaneous. The governments had no idea that this was going to happen. When they encouraged a bit of morale-boosting gifts to be sent to the troops, and the Germans even sent small Christmas trees, the British were first baffled and then mesmerized by seeing those lights like footlights in a theater across the expanse of no man's land. And it was not a big expanse. No man's land wasn't any wider than the width of a football field from spectators on one side to spectators on the other.
Right.
That meant that the troops could hear each other, could see each other, even shoot at each other almost point blank. It was death to raise your head above a trench. But the Germans, with their Christmas trees, not only lit the candles on the trees, but began singing Silent Night. And the British recognized Silent Night. It was their song, too. And pretty soon, carols and other songs began wafting across the trenches from side to side. You couldn't have done anything in no man's land, even at the time of the truce, without getting rid of the corpses. No man's land might have been only 65 or 70 yards wide, but over the weeks of war, it had filled with corpses. Christmas morning, they buried the bodies jointly. They were moving informal services. Both sides recognized that they knew the 23rd Psalm. It was repeated in German and in English. The bodies were buried. And once the bodies were buried, they had a football pitch, a soccer pitch.
They had a place where they could play soccer. And whose idea was it initially to have a competition at soccer?
I think it happened spontaneously up and down the line. It was the working man's game. They longed for that opportunity. The Scott troops kilted in that terrible weather. The Scott troops even brought soccer balls into the trenches and hoped for a chance to use them.
You write of the war itself, quote, "Both sides were misled by half-truths. Beneath the artificial hatred, each respected the other. Victory, if it came at all, would be long delayed, costly, and worthless. Perhaps a football match, after which both sides went home, might be a better solution." And I gather there were soldiers on both sides who felt that way.
Yes, William Dawkins of the East Kents recalled, "It was told to me that our lieutenant colonel threatened our soldiers with machine guns. Mm. Had one of those big mouths," he meant upper-level officers, "gathered together 10,000 footballs, what a happy solution that would have been without bloodshed."
What a beautiful thought.
Of course, it didn't happen. There were nearly four more years of war, three more Christmases of war. There never was another Christmas truce. There hasn't been another one in the history of warfare before or since. And millions died and nothing gained because the peace led to another war in 1939, the Second World War.
Of the truce, at one point in the book, you write, "Christmas 1914 evokes the stubborn humanity within us and suggests an unrealized potential." I know you wrote those words some years ago, but I wonder if you feel they have particular meaning once again now.
I think they have meaning that is ironic in the circumstances, because we can only have truces of the sort that were celebrated by those men in 1914 at Christmas when you have a common culture across the no man's land, when the troops believe in the same thing, have the same backgrounds roughly. And you could do that then because not only did both sides sing Silent Night, for example, the Germans were even able to sing Tipperary in German back to the British. And but how can you do that with a culture that is alien? I was a young officer in the Korean War. We had no common contacts. They didn't talk our language. They didn't look like us. They didn't sound like us. There was nothing we had that was in any way compatible. The same thing could certainly be said of a potential war in Iraq or a potential war anywhere where there isn't a commonality of culture.
There is the commonality of soccer, though, interestingly enough. The Koreans play soccer. The Iraqis play soccer. The U.S., the English, they all play soccer. There
yes,
is kind of the hope
it's,
of that kind of commonality, perhaps.
It is the world game, certainly. When they talk about the World Cup, it means something about soccer. But I don't recall any attempt to play soccer between the two sides in Korea. I was there for two Christmases during the war. Nothing like that ever happened. I don't know if that attempt was even thought of. Maybe now that there has been a revival of interest in that Christmas truce, we'll think about that again.
My conversation with Stanley Weintraub about his book Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce, will be featured in this week's program. We'll also be reprising Doug Trabue's celebration of goalie masks past and present. You'll have another opportunity to hear Karen Given's story about a youth league for children who have suffered abuse and neglect, children who are now learning how to socialize through the games they're playing, and my story about a hill climb involving antique cars and veteran drivers will also make another appearance, as will my story of a little girl whose special present, a smiling yellow dog, came courtesy of the mechanical claw in an arcade game. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.